No, I don't think it takes
Hello,
away
children.
evidence.
What did we learn today?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, don't frame it like that. Yeah, that's the point, I think.
Or something, you know.
Well, that was great.
Yeah, no, that was,
I really enjoyed it.
That was great. The book's great. It was chatting to was great. I mean, just so many different examples, and I love the stuff at the end on Murray Rothbard as well. Just because that was an angle that hadn't occurred to me, but actually ended up tying some things together.
Yeah, me too. The Murray, the way in which she located Murray Rothbard in that moment of the Republicans taking back Congress in the early 90s or the mid 90s, and advising Pat Buchanan and switching over from the elite influence neoliberalism to the idea of a bottom-up neoliberalism that would end up destroying the state, and how this was inspired by the end of the Cold War. All of that was really, really good stuff, and an interesting counterpoint into the very arch knee kind of Geneva school, as he puts it, snooty cosmopolitan elite neoliberals who harked back to the kind of golden era of the first half of the 20th century in Europe, the interwar period, and so on. All
yeah,
of that.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
really, it was a really good kind of way to frame the changes that we've seen in how neoliberalism has kind of metamorphosed over the last 30-40 years.
Yeah, absolutely. For listeners' benefit, this is our kind of post-interview chat that we're having after having recorded with Quinn Slobodian on his book Globalists. This is kind of the synthesis. We try to synthesize it.
It's like the after party or the hotel lobby after the after party.
You don't sound very excited about being in the hotel.
Yeah,
lobby
and it's not called that.
No, it's not, but it's equivalent.
The bunga after
some
party.
Of the best, yeah. let's be serious. Like, some of the best parts of the party happen in the after party, in the hotel lobby. So some of the things that we wanted to pick up on to take forward from the discussion were about misconceptions. Continuing what Quinn kind of primed us for and raised the idea of misconceptions of neoliberalism. Things that people think might be neoliberal but aren't, or vice versa. Things that people don't think are neoliberal but actually do fit within the model.
Right. I mean, I always try to go back to like what I think are the what is the most popular framing of neoliberalism today. I mean, most popular incorrect one, the one that's used by leftists as a slur word. You know,
a swear word.
Yeah, swear word, that's what I meant. But, you know, where at its worst, it's just seen as you don't care, right? It's like, if you're a neoliberal, you're someone who doesn't care, who isn't willing to use the politics or the state to make things better. What I mentioned at the end of the thing with Quinn, which is that, you know, this idea of the kind of Thatcherite vision of neoliberalism as a kind of a sort of, as a faux popular doctrine, right? That, you know, this popular capital, everyone can own shares, everyone can go out and do what they want.
But it was a popular doctrine.
No, it was. But what comes through in Quinn's work on, you know, ordoliberalism and, you know, Vienna-based neoliberalism is precisely that it was how anti-mass, anti-popular, and anti-democratic that thinking was.
I think the misconception, I think, and it's one that is hard to get away from, is neoliberalism is used as a on one hand, a kind of very small, in a very small way, that it's used to refer to kind of, I don't know, selfishness, greed, kind of individual, you know, individual moral failings, effectively. As a shorthand, it's a way of reviving, I suppose, certain kinds of almost Christian themes of moral critique of a world that's become too greedy, too
imperialist. And it's ethical socialism which opposes itself to that vision of neoliberalism.
Yeah. And that's so it's a kind of a Christian socialism, I suppose.
And that's what most left—that's what most left-right opposition, you know, over the 90s and 2000s looked like, right? It was a kind of
It's community anti-community, neoliberalism as a acid washing away community that any community theory can oppose.
So you have that small version, but then I think you also have a very big version of that where it's used in kind of enormously. It's used in this kind of incredibly kind of sweeping, abstract and overblown, highfalutin way of neoliberalism is suddenly, you know, something which is a term of political economy, law, as Quinn said, sociology, perhaps, you know, suddenly becomes part of these grand kind of philosophical denunciations, you know, talking about Deleuze and Guattari and how neoliberal rhizomes are reordering our, you know, reordering the identity alterity nexus at the heart of our preconceptions of what it means to be human and this kind of stuff.
I can't tell if you're being serious or if you're like parodying it. But
it's impossible.
Phil has unexpectedly shifted to being a Deleuzian from this point on.
Yeah, exactly.
The technical term is Deleuzer. Thank you. So it's at once kind of the very big, you know, it's kind of cast at this incredibly abstract level and also this kind of very immediate person, sorry, at the very immediate level where, you know, this person is neoliberal because they're too attached to material things or something like that.
Well, I mean, I think there is something to talking about neoliberalism as a logic of competition. I mean, a past guest, William Davis, talks about it in those terms, and we referenced that. We talked a little bit with him on the episode, you know, from a couple of months back. And I think, I mean, it's certainly there, but I mean, it's interesting how Quinn's narrative talks about something so different that it's actually hard to really bridge the two. And maybe the answer to that is just to all that stuff about a logic of competition and the neoliberal subject and all that. Maybe it's best not called neoliberal. And actually, we should be coming up with different concepts and different terms to describe those kind of more sociological aspects. And when we're talking about, you know, what we talked about in the interview with Quinn, use actually the term neoliberalism.
Yeah, it's a big question to what extent the account that Quinn gives is incompatible with the account that somebody like William Davis would give, which is essentially a Weberian one. It's about rationalization. Maybe that's the term to bring back. It's about quantification, optimization, taking things which were previously almost impossible to make into numbers and then putting them into numbers and making them compete with each other. And I think I think what Quinn's book and the discussion that we had with him really emphasized, which is extremely important, is how it is about that insulation of economic processes from democratic control, because that is probably the key, at least in the British context, probably the key sort of dynamic or the key political question at the moment, more than some of the cultural questions.
But not just the British dynamic.
No, I think the global one. I mean,
any country in the EU.
Yeah, so he said the EU is a dry run for the WTO, and I thought it was a great point. But also he doesn't directly discuss this in the book in great detail, but mentions that part of it also is the tax haven model, the economic zone model, where you carve out a territory within a state, or the kind of the micro state and you set this kind of the economic constitution, you fix it in such a way that it ensures that the market is firmly encased within a legal and political structure that will protect the functioning of the market as the model is supposed to work. So it's not just the kind of super great grand kind of supranational experiments like the European Union or global integration like the WTO, but also places like Hong Kong under British colonialism, export processing zones, tax havens, and so on. All these kind of a kind of archipelago around the world as well, where
it's,
you have
it,
these
it's
effects visible.
It's interesting, though, that because it occurs to me that there is a certain similarity between what you just mentioned in terms of, you know, Hong Kong or Singapore or expert processing zone, like I think of like Manaus's free zone, in that way that that's obviously interlinked to the global economy. I mean, that's very much the point, and it's a little site of the global economy, which doesn't have, you know, politics interfering. It's completely rule-bound in a way to protect the free flow of capital. But then also refer to what we were talking about at the end of the discussion with Quinn, which is the kind of Murray Rothbard populist notion, you know, of a kind of neoliberal breakaway, or even thinking about someone like Peter Thiel and the kind of seasteading notion of breaking away. And it's I'm trying to see if there's any kind of link between those
notion.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you know, then you're getting kind of you're getting really far away from the Hayekian idea of building this of building a, you know, that kind of form of global or regional integration, you know, which tries to circumscribe national politics. But there is, but there is that still. I mean, I guess the thread there is anti-democracy and a form of anti-politics or of circumscribing of politics, which brings me back to the episode that we did with Ishai Landa, which came out at the beginning of the year, January 2019, which precisely looks at how so many liberal ideas actually end up tending towards authoritarian and very anti-democratic thought, and actually that really underpinning a lot of liberal thought. I guess it's something that maybe isn't recognized enough, and it was brought to mind even today when someone on Twitter posted something from the Von Mises Institute in Brazil, which was actually kind of a very racist notion, saying, well, you know, you can't have, yeah, you might like, you know, Swedish social democracy, but you can't have that with a heterogeneous society. You can't have that with immigration, with mixed races and multiculturalism and so on, because that form of social solidarity within a nation state is only possible when you have a completely homogenous society. This was subsequently deleted. But there again, you have...
Wait. I don't think... I think there's maybe a point there, which ties into when we had James Hartfield on. He made the point that the old social democratic state was in fact much more racist than the neoliberal state, and that was the way in which people were bound to the state, was the kind of welfare warfare state of the first I don't know, three quarters of the 20th century in the advanced capitalist world anyway. People, they got people to fight for the country, and in return were given benefits for them. And it was a way of binding a particular population to a particular political order. And it was heavily racialized in the West. So I think, you know, there is a point there, and it shouldn't be forgotten in a kind of neoliberal nostalgia for the welfare state.
Now, and you're right to specify that that's in the West, because I mean I think also the, you know, neoliberal states are very operate racialized models, or, you know, implicitly or explicitly in the global South. But in the West, at least, I think it's right. I mean, at least what, you know, James Hartfield has written about and talked to us about was, yeah, the way in which neoliberals have, well, you know, what we called on the episode woke neoliberalism, how they've used their, you know, a kind of an adherence to multiculturalism as a form of legitimation and, you know, of bringing in marginal or previously excluded populations into the mainstream.
I guess I've got two questions on this, or two things which, you know, kind of disconnected thoughts. The first one is, I mean, is it the case that very, very recently fascism has come to replace neoliberalism as a kind of the opposite? Yeah, no, I guess kind of the enemy of the left. It seems like this was a word that was massively overused in a way that the word fascist is now massively overused. So everybody is now a fascist, whereas previously everybody who had even a remotely right wing and often a conservative political ideology was a neoliberal.
Yeah, I think that probably is right. I mean, but it's also, I mean, it's the old kind of Stalinist Popular Front tactic to denounce anyone who's outside of the alliance as a fascist, and that was put in abeyance, I suppose, for a while, and has now come back and it expresses the disintegration. I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, maybe it's part of that. It just expresses the disintegration of left neoliberalism. So you had the left had been effectively incorporated into the neoliberal order. And as neoliberalism crumbles and they're left disoriented and confused, they reach for fascism as a way to make sense of what's happening, feeling exceptionally so, I suppose, betrayed by the fact that they vested their hopes in the neoliberal order. It turned out to be limited, and you know, that it's crumbled away of its own accord without any effort from the left, and now they're left kind of shrieking fascist at everything.
So it's it's kind of NLOB's left neoliberal order breakdown syndrome, if you will.
I mean, but I think that's a good point, though, that Phil makes, that left neoliberalism has completely collapsed. I mean, you know, you can see the fate of socialist parties across Europe as the best example of that. But I think also, you know, I mean, it just has no intellectual force, and the sort of challengers even within those parties, you know, the kind of young social democrats in Germany, or, you know, in whatever in France, or, you know, even aspects of Momentum and Corbynism in Britain, are, you know, seeking to challenge neoliberalism, but often in very, I guess, minor ways, because there isn't a complete break with neoliberalism. Meanwhile, the kind of neoliberal edifice starts to adapt more nationalist and populist elements, as, you know, the British Tory Party has done.
I'm not sure, you know, I mean, I guess it seems to be, you know, let's see what happens. But it seems to me, and this ties into another kind of theme on the podcast, is that that kind of Rothbardian vision of neoliberalism, at least as laid out by Quinn, that seems to me maybe to fit Brazil better than any other country I can think of at the moment, even more so than... Bless you, my child. Who is that?
Sorry, that's me.
Can you? Hey, do you know you can.
Pollen is neoliberal.
Pollen is so neoliberal.
You can put. No, anyway, whatever.
I know I can put myself on mute, but I just wanted listeners to realize that I'm human. I'm not just an analytical
right.
bot.
Phil, your point that the Rothbardian vision of neoliberalism is most best applied to Brazil today.
It works better than the Trump, you know, better than Trump, I think. So, I mean, you know, according to what Quinn was saying, the kind of the real, you know, is Pat Buchanan and presumably, what's his face, Newt Gingrich. So it's the kind of Republican revolution of the 90s when the Republicans finally, you know, democratic domination in the post-war era, they end it, they take, they inaugurate a new era in congressional power. In the post-Cold War era. So, I mean, that seems to be kind of the Rothbardian moment more than Trump, I guess. I'm guessing it's the background also for the Trumpian moment, but it seems like, you know, maybe Bolsonaro's Brazil is maybe that place where you have the using popular anger. So turning against the elite and using popular anger to dissolve state power.
Right.
And that seems to be very much part of Bolsonaro's project. So it has that right-wing edge, but at the same time, it's still neoliberal in a way that I think, you know, Trump isn't, you know, because the Trump thing comes with protectionism and pandering to blue-collar Rust Belt constituencies and trade wars and all of that, whereas the Bolsonaro thing, having the hardcore Brazilian neoliberal on his economic team, you know, I think that it's a different kind of project.
Doesn't Quinn's analysis give us quite a clear kind of litmus test for whether something is neoliberal or not, or the extent to which it is? Because I think that point, to repeat it again, about the insulation of various economic forms from democratic accountability, that's the key thing. It's not about any of the modes of politics or the methods of mobilization. It's about the realm of contestability, the kind of the topic of the topics of politics and the sort of the international structures into which domestic politics are attempted to be fitted.
Right. I mean, I think this is the thing. I it's a good point, because in relation to Brazil as well, that naked class war from above and the destruction of state capacities, the funding, you know, funding of education or, you know, welfare or whatever, that doesn't necessarily need to be seen as neoliberal. specifically.
Could be conservative.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what necessarily one would term it, but I mean...
But it is neoliberal in Brazil, isn't it?
Well, yes, I mean,
of his economics minister, I can't remember now his name.
Yeah, Paulo Guedes, who's like an ultra neoliberal, and even the Chicago School people think like he's a little bit too far. That's right. I mean, and there's an attempt to use a popular liberalism, a popular neoliberalism, I guess, against the state, against the center left, you know, against the establishment, that we're you know, we're breaking down all these boundaries which kind of keep people down. But there's a thing that in Brazil that project seems to be coming apart at the seams because Bolsonaro is completely useless. But let's at least take it. So, you know, I guess if the whole thing falls apart very quickly, we'll have to reevaluate because it's not worth talking about something which lasted for 6 months. But perhaps
it proves the point that maybe the time of neoliberalism is over.
Right. No, because I mean,
if that project falls apart and Bolsonaro has to pivot more towards the military or nationalism.
Well, because I mean, the liberalism that's there, I mean, it's really just giving a free hand to, you know, to landowners and to certain sections of capital, probably the most reactionary sections of capital. And so, yeah, rolling back some state protection there, but it's not, but it that doesn't really chime with Quinn Slobodian's description of, you know, of ordo globalism, of trying to create certain orders, a certain type of order, which places rules on what the state can do, and tries to create to insulate. Well, I think it's interesting because he talks not about insulating, but in terms of someone remind me of the term he prefers to use.
Encasing
rather than insulating the market. And that isn't really what's happening in Brazil. I mean, it's really just a bit of a free-for-all. In fact, what probably is happening in Brazil looks more like the crude misunderstanding of neoliberalism than Quinn Slobodian's proposition of how to understand it. And then I guess just to bring it back to Trump, because I actually had noted down as one of the questions that we should maybe discuss is whether we should see Trump as a neoliberal. All that playing to, you know, kind of Rust Belt and sort of populist measures of of pulling out of NAFTA and so on, that has faded. I mean, that was something that was done on the campaign trail, right? And you can see how many of those Trump supporters have actually ended up kind of just tiring with Trump and feeling like he wasn't actually bringing change and he became part of the machine.
Yeah, it's almost like he was a kind of pantomime distraction from the actual political policies that were being put forward. But I think it is important for the left to broaden, you know, to have a bit of a broader vocabulary than neoliberal or not, fascist or not. And I don't think either neoliberal or fascist is a good description of Trump. There's so many aspects, at least rhetorically, of economic nationalism that mean that you, yeah, I mean,
but he represents the breakdown of the neoliberal order. I mean, I think that's the really hard thing to accept for the left, right? Because they define themselves against neoliberalism, it's difficult to accept the fact that the neoliberalism is being broken down by Trump and not by them.
This is
part of the difficulty of what's, you know, and not least the fact also that he has working class support. He stole millions of people who voted for Obama in the Northeast decided they didn't want to vote for Hillary. So I think
can be overstated. I mean, it was decisive, but it wasn't.
No,
en
sure.
Masse,
but my point is, like, I think this is, Trump clearly is a neoliberal. And he's quite the opposite. He's disintegrating the neoliberal era. This is the form it's taking in the US. And the left has difficulty accepting that, I think, because, they were the ones who opposed themselves to neoliberalism, but were unable to overthrow it.
But I think especially when we're talking about the global hegemon, the United States, it's vitally important that you talk about, you know, a presidency in relation to the international order and how they relate to that, not their domestic policies, precisely for the reasons that Quinn discusses, which is that ordo globalism is precisely about creating a sort of a global order for the world market and protecting it.
But
they're
very tightly connected, you know, because it's all about how we got ripped off, we did bad deals, I'm going to do better deals. So those two, you know, those two things are very tightly connected with NAFTA negotiations, even tariffs against Canada, you know, the trade war with brewing trade war with Germany and with China, all of this. So the, you know, it's the two things are directly connected in Trump's political project.
Yeah,
so
I quite like the idea that Trump is a symptom above all of the decline or the breakdown of left neoliberalism, that really he's to go back to Hillary again, he's a symptom of the decline of Hillary Clintonism.
We really need to do an episode on Hillary.
Every episode is on Hillary.
Wait, so
like every book about America is about the idea of America.
Right. To pull in another example, just because we've talked about it, there's another episode that we can refer back to, which is what we did on Hungary last year. You know, Orban there is, you know, creates a paradise for German capital, basically. Where is that reading recently where it was described it as having kind of, you know, a little China or even somewhere lower down the, you know, the wage scale within the middle of the center of Europe. At the same time as obviously having all these nationalist and sort of populist and very reactionary characteristics. And again, there, is that just a maintenance of neoliberalism, but adding in these nationalist characteristics as a way of legitimizing neoliberalism, but without actually changing anything in essence? And I guess that's kind of my question about, are we still in neoliberalism? Are we still in the neoliberal period? Does the new kind of anti-globalist alliance, you know, in big scare quotes, does that represent an end to neoliberalism?
It's an interesting thought, I guess. But also, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that both Orban and Polish Law and Justice Party have gone against economic orthodoxy, what they were instructed to do or advised to do by international financial institutions. So there they've created kind of business-friendly environments, particularly for German investment, German industrial investment, and also for their local capitalists and oligarchs connected to the regime and so on, all of that. But I'm not sure that it's neoliberal. And if it is, you know, it's also highly regional as well. I mean, I think that's important. It's very much locked into the dominant economy in Europe. It's not quite pitched at the global level. And Orban's political project is also pitched, you know, in defending Europe from Muslim immigration, from foreigners and terrorism and so on. So I think it's inflected in a very particular way.
Mm.
Yeah, I think the key institution here, sorry to talk about it again and again, is the European Union. I mean, that those four freedoms, goods, services, capital and labor, that is neoliberalism. Those four freedoms and this whole architecture of trying to remove decisions about the movement, the flexibility of those four factors of production, that is the neoliberal project. And it's important to distinguish that from, I guess, the, you know, neoliberalism with Hungarian characteristics, which might be occurring, or with German capital characteristics, which might be occurring in Hungary. Important not to kind of miss the wood for the trees in that sense. And I think that's why Quinn's book and the discussion is so important, to realize that issue of scale is a really important one. It's not, you know, it is. The transnational aspect of it is extremely important.
I'm worried that any moment now George is going to break out a quote about how we live in an interregnum in which a variety of morbid symptoms appear.
Yeah.
Who's that by? I haven't heard that one before.
But I think that the thing about the EU, and it was, you were right, Phil, at the very beginning to say to Quinn, I mean, you know, you've kind of written a book about the EU, not explicitly, of course, but, you know, that is the most perfect international structure yet devised that fits with the, you know, the ordoliberals and the neoliberals' vision of, yeah, of politics. And I put politics in scare quotes because, of course, they want to limit, you know, national politics to the greatest, yeah, extent. And I think we shouldn't be, just because it is that, you know, so they've created the European Union obviously undertakes certain state functions and coordinating function, and it's, you know, as the kind of right wing Eurosceptics love to complain about, oh, it creates too much regulation and so on. But this is all for the, it might not be the most rational form because of the implementation of certain policies and certain dysfunctions. But it basically, the objective is to create a space for the smooth flow of capital. And one shouldn't be distracted when certain specific capitals or representatives of national capital start complain about specific aspects of the EU. So when the British complain about the British capitalists complain about the EU, for example, or less even that, but more like right-wing British politicians complain about the EU, it's not anti-neoliberal, it's just that they're grating against certain particular aspects of that.
Yeah, but also that they fail to understand the limits of their own project. So, they imagine that it could be done without the bad parts of the things they don't like about the European Union. Only speaks to how little they understand what's necessary in order to keep the whole structure together. So, I think it speaks, they're unwilling and unable to, the fact that they're unable to see the compromises that are necessary to keep what they like effectively in existence only speaks, I think, to the weakness of their ideas and their theories to begin with.
Well, and Quinn mentions this in his book that, for the British, perhaps the European Union is too European and they have perhaps a very neoliberal vision, but which is a global one where, that they're scared of the EU becoming too domineering and too much of a regional hegemon instead of Britain being able to play out in the whole world. But I think that's really fantastical, right? I mean, that's what you're saying. They don't appreciate the limitations of their own vision or the practical limitations of that vision.
How it doesn't work, where it breaks down, where it's no longer sustainable.
So maybe as a way to close this out, we should ask the question, because it's sometimes thrown at Lexiters, I guess, that, Brexit is the greatest neoliberal dream because it's fits in with, the disaster capitalist narrative that, you create chaos and then you can privatize things and so on. Is Brexit not a kind of left-wing vision of Brexit, but actually existing Brexit? Is it neoliberal?
Well, I'm not a Lexiter, so I should hand it over to George to answer that question.
God, I knew you were going to say that.
It feels
not
grating
either.
Against the term Lexit. It's just, anyway.
It's true, though. I mean, it's annoying that Phil makes the point because it is an important and good point.
How is it annoying that I make it?
The Brexit is progressive full stop, and that it does precisely in whatever form it ends up in the short and medium term, it does go against this insulation, this encasement of economics from politics. And that is extremely important. It's not about whether you win or lose in the extremely short term. It's the fact that more democratic contestation is essentially an anti-neoliberal force. And that's, that's what socialists should be arguing for. Sorry to just deliver the set piece, but I mean that's the point, isn't it? That the socialism is democracy, and that neoliberalism is incompatible with democracy, as the EU is incompatible with democracy,
with mass popular rule and self-government. Yeah, I think it goes further though as well, because I think this is a point made by the political theorist Richard Tuck, that paradoxically Brexit means that Britain is becoming, the constitutional form of Britain is becoming more based around popular sovereignty, precisely along a kind of continental, to say it was Jacobin would be to push it too far, but it's dissolving away parliamentary sovereignty. And the precondition for Britain's integration into the European Union was very much parliamentary sovereignty, parliamentary supremacy. The idea that once this group is elected, they can essentially do whatever they will with that power, independent of popular will, and it was parliamentary sovereignty that enabled entry into the European Union or its precursors in the 1970s, and that is what's being dissolved now because Parliament is being shown to be incapable of enacting popular will. And it's in collision also with the idea of popular sovereignty, which is manifested in the result of the referendum. So paradoxically, Brexit is also bringing Britain closer to precisely the popular sovereignty that neoliberals have always been so suspicious of, as Quinn emphasized in the talk.
Well, to bring us back round then, I think it's my main takeaway from this whole thing has been the degree to which popular sovereignty is the enemy of neoliberalism, and that they stand very clearly opposed, not adjacent, not diagonal in any way, but that the neoliberal project is a way of defeating popular sovereignty. And Quinn puts this great, I think, in a subtitle.
Sidestepping it.
Well,
sidestepping it almost.
Well, but it's also circumscribing it, right? I mean, it's allowing some politics to happen in, you know, the cultural sphere, which is what Quinn references in relation to the Habsburg Empire, that, you know, you had some politics which had dealt with culture, but in terms of the importance.
Yeah, you get your own language schools and that kind of business.
Precisely. But I think he puts it very well with a neat subtitle in the book, which is people, a world of people without a people. So it's against the formation of a demos, and that's what neoliberalism fundamentally aims at.
And it's actually linked to the left neoliberalism, because that was the offer. You know, like, everyone's going to get their culture, everyone's going to, you know, we're going to have a celebration of diversity and identity, and everyone's going to be put in their little box, and you'll get funding for your,
your pet projects or whatever,
Yeah, exactly. You'll get money for that. And that was the deal. So a kind of similar to the inspiration, if Quinn is right, you know, the inspiration comes from the Habsburg Empire, where you have economic rule, which is an economic constitution, which is locked in, but you get kind of people feel that they have some degree of political autonomy or in cultural expression. And that's very much the kind of model that ruled in 1990s ideas of globalization. Cultural differences, but economic uniformity and lack of political control over the economy.
Yeah, and the only form of politics that you have is cultural politics. Yeah, exactly. Culture wars. All right.
It was funny that that was your takeaway. My takeaway was you need to build a Mon Pelerin society for the left. You need to go on junkets as many as you can. For example, to California.
Right. That's more
need to find some money.
More junkets for the lads. All right. I think we should leave it there. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Alex.
I don't know why I said thanks, guys. Maybe I should do something else.
Edit that out.
Namaste. Namaste.
Okay.
This is market Stalinism at its best.
Exactly. It's organic, but also organized.